attitude. We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
The independence case is a powerful one.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Dan Moraine, a veteran American journalist who has worked on such distinguished publications as the Sacramento Bee and the LA Times, to discuss his latest book, a biography of the current Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris. The book is Kamala's Way. Welcome to the podcast, Dan.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Will.
It's great to have you on, Dan. And the first question that I'd like to ask is perhaps a bit of an obvious one, but what was it that made you decide to write the book in the first place?
Well, I must say it sort of fell into my lap. I've been a journalist, like you said, in California for the better part of 44 years, and I retired, sort of, in March of 2020, and that was, of course, the month when everything shut down in California. Mm-hmm. I was freelancing a little bit, walking my dog, and one of the pieces that I did was about Kamala Harris for the Washington Post. Sort of a long story short, the editor of that Post story urged that I write a book about Kamala Harris. He had a friend at Simon & Schuster who was the editor, this fabulous editor, Priscilla Payton. And this piece ran on August 11th of 2020, the day Joe Biden picked Kamala Harris. Mm. And by the beginning of September, I had embarked on this book. And, so it really did fall into my lap. And my deadline was November 3rd. And November 3rd, of course, was election day out here and over here. And so I handed in the final chapters at about 5 p.m. on November 3rd and walked downstairs to join my wife to watch the returns. And there it is. So it's been a very interesting year following Kamala Harris's. As you would know from reading the book, I first wrote about her in 1994 when I was at the LA Times and she had got a plum appointment, a nice political appointment from her good friend, Willie Brown, then good friend, who was the speaker, very powerful politician out here in California. And then I got to know her better during the 2008 presidential campaign, which I helped cover for the LA Times. Mm. And then got to know her better when she ran for attorney general in 2010. I was then working at the Sacramento Bee as an editorial writer and a columnist. So I followed her. I was not on the presidential campaign trail. I certainly know her, knew her. Have watched her with great interest. She's a fascinating politician.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I think that you make quite clear from the start of the book is the influence that Vice President Harris's parents had on her subsequent political career, particularly her mother. How important do you think it is for a successful politician like Vice President Harris to have politically aware or politically active parents? Or do you think that in some cases it is perhaps not always relevant, but certainly it does help, as it obviously did in the case of Vice President Harris?
Yeah, so that's so interesting. I mean, without a doubt, her mother was politically engaged. Mm-hmm. Her father similarly was. She was born in Oakland, California, which in 1964 is a very liberal city even then, and grew up in Berkeley, which is renowned for its liberal thought. It's among the most liberal cities in the United States. And in the 1960s, it was, your listeners will know, that was quite a time of political roiling in America, and particularly in California. I mean, this was the center of the anti-Vietnam War movement. Mm. It was the center of the environmental movement. It was the center of the justice movement. I mean, all kinds of things were swirling around Berkeley when she was a little girl. And her parents were part of that. Her parents were, you know, they weren't out front leaders in the civil rights movement, but they were certainly there. They brought her to demonstrations on behalf of civil rights. It's really her mother who is, I think, most influential. Her parents split when she was a young girl, divorced in, my recollection is 1972. So, you know, she was a child. Her father, who became a professor at Stanford University, one of the great universities in America, an economics professor, had joint custody or shared custody of Kamala and her younger sister, Maya. And he did, so he was a Jamaican native, had come over to study. And so he tried to impart to her and her sister their Jamaican roots. They spent time in Jamaica, at least one trip, maybe more, I'm not sure. But it was really her mother who was the greatest influence, Shyamala Gopalan Harris. She too was an immigrant from India, came over in 1959, not yet 20 years old, and with the goal of studying to become a scientist. I mean, imagine the guts of that woman to do such a thing. I mean, she was 19. She was in a country where there were still arranged marriages, and she basically persuaded her father that she should be allowed to come to California, halfway around the world, place she had never been, to study to become a scientist, and so here she was. And so, you know, really a bold woman. I never met her, but I certainly know people who knew her, and just talk about what a, you know, force of nature she was, and brilliant, became a PhD researcher, cancer researcher. So I think that she had the greater influence on Kamala Harris than her father. I mean, it's so interesting. I mean, you know, as you know, having read the book, that Harris did not help in any way, and her political people around her didn't help. She was running for vice president. She was busy when I was working on this book. But it's apparent that she's got a distant relationship with her father, Donald Harris. If he was at the inauguration on January 20th of 2021, it's not readily apparent. I mean, there was no press coverage of such an appearance. I think somebody would have noted it. I watched the inauguration on C-SPAN. I think I would have recognized him from all the photos I've seen of him, but you know, so I don't think he was there. And can you imagine if he wasn't? And I say your daughter becomes vice president. I mean, what a huge accomplishment! And you're not there. You know, you're not one of the honored guests if you're the father. I'm the father of three kids, two daughters, and I just can't imagine. So there is this, you know, she has said very little about him publicly. When she writes her memoir, maybe she'll explain it in more detail, what the relationship has been. She was very close to her mother. She talks about her mother to this day. She makes reference to her mother, as does Kamala Harris's sister, Maya. So anyway, this is interesting.
Yes. And one of the things I think that you raise there is that, as you point out in the book as well, is that as the children of immigrants, very much at the part of the civil rights movement in California was something that was integral to her upbringing. And she referenced during the presidential campaign the system of busing, which she was a part of whilst as a child. How right. much of that kind of situation where often in America during that period, and obviously in some parts of America still quite a bit now, the emphasis on the colour of a person's skin, how much do you think that that made her even more determined to, you know, achieve a great office, that because there were so many, you know, prejudicial people that she would have encountered both of as a child and then as she grew older, how much of an influence do you think that that made on her and gave her that kind of like extra determination to get as far as she possibly could?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, she's a very driven person. Mm. You know, and she, you know, I don't know, kind of maybe the definition of overachiever, but she's very, very smart. She is, and she, you know, she comes to meetings prepared when she would come to the editorial board in Sacramento Bee. I mean, she knew exactly what she wanted to do. She had been briefed. She understood the issues really well. You know, this is a very smart woman. Easy and often underestimated. I mean, it's just the reality of, I think, being a woman in politics and a woman of color in politics. I mean, it's just, I mean, of course, she is a smart, driven, very skilled politician. And she knows that she's who she is, right? I mean, it's just part of who she is. Now, in terms of busing, you know, busing in Berkeley was a lot different than busing in the southern states, or busing in Boston, where Los Angeles. I mean, parts of California where busing was really resisted by parents, black and white. And Berkeley, on the other hand, really did embrace busing after by the time she was bused, which was in 1970. She wasn't part of the first class that was bused. She was too young, but by the time she was bused from the flats where people of color lived, up to the hills where wealthier white people lived, to that school, you know, Berkeley had embraced it. You know, Berkeley thought that the people of Berkeley had initially fought it. There was an attempt to recall the school board members. That failed, and the people of Berkeley ultimately became very supportive of it. So you asked how much. How big a part does race play in who she is? I mean, it's who she, you know, it's part of who she is. It's not, you know, I would not define her as a black South Asian, you know, a child of a man from Jamaica and a woman from South Asia. I would first define her as a really skilled politician, a really smart person, and you know, but absolutely on the list is, yeah, she's a woman of color, and that matters. I mean, it matters to her. She talks about how when she was a prosecutor, sending criminals off to prison for long periods of time for, you know, crimes they had committed, that she talks about the racism in the justice system. I mean, it's part of who she is. She understands it on a fundamental level. So yeah, of course, it's all part of who she is But you know, people who define her as simply a woman of color are kind of missing missing important elements of who she is.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touched upon her time as a prosecutor there, and I think what's interesting in the book is how you can chart her rise through the legal profession, and how she really was in many ways a natural lawyer and a natural prosecutor as well. The way that she dealt with so many cases was incredibly highly effective, and you can see how she ended up as Attorney General. What do you think it was that particularly drew her to the law, and what do you think it was about the legal system that made her decide to become a lawyer and a prosecutor and eventually Attorney General?
Yeah, well, it is, it's one of the things that you would ask if, that I would have asked had I been able to sit down and do a biographical interview with her. I interviewed her many times before, but it was always about policy issues, never about, her family life or anything like that. What she has said was that she saw the law as a way to help transform as being a transformative thing. I mean, America remains still a country where the rule of law matters, and what better way to make sure that remains the case than to be a lawyer. And then in terms of being a prosecutor, it certainly did surprise her family that she chose this route. I think one reason she did was to try to change the justice system from within. Mm-hmm. People who, she gets caricatured quite a bit in the States as being this radical lefty. And it's just kind of, I just kind of roll my eyes because, I'm certainly no apologist for Kamala Harris. The book, I think, points out her flaws as well as her strengths. But I mean, the reality is this is a person who spent the bulk of her adult life sending people to prison for doing bad things. Right. I mean, she has maybe a progressive view of the criminal justice system. She understands that there is racism embedded in charging decisions and that sort of thing. But this is a woman who, she prosecuted a guy who tried to scalp his girlfriend. He was high on meth and he tried to, scalp her, and it didn't work the first time, and he got a sharper knife and it worked the second time. This is the kind of case that she handled. It's a heavy duty, felony, violent, awful domestic violence crime. So she has seen the really ugly side of human behavior. Any prosecutor would in Alameda County and then in San Francisco. I mean, Alameda, when she was there, it was at a high point in homicides in that city. In San Francisco, when she was a prosecutor, there was it was one of the worst years for homicides. And then when she became district attorney, the same thing. District attorney is an elective office in San Francisco, and she was the elected district attorney for 6 years before she ran for California Attorney General. So she has, she certainly has liberal views on reproductive rights and same-sex marriage and kind of those sorts, the environment and that sort of thing. But she spent a lot of time sending a lot of people to prison. And I think that that shapes one's outlook as well.
Hmm. Yeah. And I think that one of the things that certainly attracted a lot of people to her before she ran for president in 2020 was that ability, as you mentioned, to be a progressive prosecutor, to stand up against some of the injustices that people have suffered at the hands of others, and do so perhaps not in a way that some prosecutors are doing, which is perhaps a more moralistic or conservative way, but in a very progressive way. And we saw that when she was in the Senate during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. How much of a role do you think that played in her eventually running for the presidency, the Kavanaugh hearings? Because that was one of the moments that really, defined her in terms of the public imagination for people perhaps who would not come across her, or for people who weren't from California.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think she, the people around her started thinking about her running for president on election night 2016. That was night that she won in a landslide the U.S. Senate seat from California, one of two Senate seats from California. She won that, but that was also the night that Donald Trump was elected. Mm. And so I know that people, her political aides were thinking, they were checking the flights to Des Moines, Iowa, and Manchester, New Hampshire. They were certainly starting to think about it. And she, I think she was thinking about running for president basically on that night, and that election night when Trump won. So, much of what she did as a U.S. senator she arrived as a star. She was somebody who the media was very interested in paying attention to, and much of what she did in those 2017, 18, and 19, she announced her presidential campaign at the beginning of 2019. Mm. Was aimed at running for president, I have no doubt. She made her final decision in 2018, as I detail in the book. But she was thinking about it before that, and so of course the Brett Kavanaugh hearing was one that in which she got a lot of attention. This was. She showed her ability to really go after her prosecutorial skills shown through. It wasn't the first time. She spent a lot of time giving Trump appointees or nominees heartburn in hearings in 2017, 18, and then 19. But really those 2 years, 17 and 18, she was, she'd be pretty tough, and people saw that, that was her calling card that was her calling card, I think, for running for president, was her ability to make Trump appointees squirm, be the prosecutor.
Yeah.
It's a big deal for her.
Mm. And I'd like to turn now just to the presidential campaign, and a part of the presidential campaign, which was another very vivid moment in which she confronted Joe Biden relating to busing that we mentioned earlier. And one of the things that you touch upon in the book is that although it was a important moment, and the moment that was repeated through the news cycles after the debate, it was one that also caused her a bit of trouble as well, because you mentioned a New York Times story from the following day in which one of her spokespeople said that although she supported busing as a method for school integration, she declined to provide additional information relating to that. And I think that this is something that you touch upon in the book and you discuss in the book is that sometimes perhaps you had a tendency to raise an issue, but then not always follow through. Do you think that this is something that is perhaps a bit of a weak spot for her as a politician, in that she can, you know, raise a particular issue but might not always be able to follow through with it if the issue becomes a bit tricky later
on? Yeah. I mean, I think that that's true. I think that when she raised busing, I'm not sure she thought about what the follow-up question was going to be. Hmm. You saw it in other aspects of her run for the presidency. It wasn't a very good campaign. She ended up dropping out before the first votes were counted. But, you know, she flip-flopped on the question of healthcare, Medicare for all, as we say in the States. She initially said she was for it, and then she thought better of it and took a different view. She has positions. She has a lot of positions. The question then is what exactly are the principles? I know what the fundamental principles are. She is supportive of civil rights. She's supportive of reproductive rights and women's health care and those sorts of things. You know, those big issues, we know where she stands, and I think those are not ever going to change. I think she's going to, you know, rethink or think through different issues. Busing maybe is one. You know, busing is an issue that was huge in the 70s, 60s, and 80s. It not so much now, right? I mean, it's just not one of those issues that people are talking about these days.
Yeah, of course. What's interesting about the book is, of course, where it ends. It ends with the election, and of course was published about the time of the inauguration, just a bit before the inauguration. So, of course, doesn't cover her vice presidency. So the obvious question is, will you be writing a follow-up covering her time as vice president? And if so, what do you think will be the major things that you would cover in such a book so far? I mean, of course, her vice presidency is nowhere near ended yet, but from what we've seen so far, what do you think you'd be looking at and thinking of particularly covering?
Well, first of all, I don't think that that's on my to-do list. I do think that she's a really interesting character, but, you know, I'm in California, she's in Washington, that's 3,000 miles away, so... So it's just, you know, it's not something in order to do this, I would have to be living and following her for 6 months. Even then, I don't think that she would, sit down and give me an interview. So, I mean, I just don't think she's giving anybody those sorts of interviews. In fact, I know she's not. That's not on my to-do list. But I do think that she's been a really interesting vice president. As we speak today, the latest poll showed that she, you know, is really underwater in terms of her favorability, and her popularity has really sunk. You know, we're a long way between now and the midterm elections this time next year, and then. When Biden runs for re-election in 2024, we're a long way away from that. Plenty of time to for her to rise back in the polls. You know, one of the things that I find so interesting about her is the stuff she's bringing to the table. There are issues that no other vice president has ever talked about. One of them is mortality among Black mothers in childbirth, right? I mean, no other vice president would ever, you know, deal with this issue. She has raised it as an issue as vice president. The Biden administration pushed through a child tax credit, so parents of children get $250, $300 a month in their bank account. That was something that she pushed when she was in the U.S. Senate. And it's something that she takes a measure of pride in, having had the Biden administration push that. So she is bringing to the fore issues that other vice presidents just, I mean, it's just not on their radar. This is not stuff they would have thought about, and she is. So I think that she's important for that reason. I think she's important for you know, who she is. I mean, I think every little girl can look at who the vice president is and you know, maybe see herself there, right? Yeah. And it's never happened before. It matters when you know, the prime minister of Barbados comes to Washington and sits down with Kamala Harris, right? I mean, these are important. It's deeper than symbolism, but symbolism also matters. You know, it would be symbolism if she weren't a substantial, smart person. She is a substantial individual. So it is more than symbolism, but it matters who, you know, who the face is of the vice president of the United States, and she's the first. So I find that is significant. Yeah. And she's been the first, you know, many times before. I mean, she's the first woman district attorney in San Francisco, the first woman attorney general in California, the first woman U.S. and first woman of color sent to the U.S. Senate from California, and only the second woman of color ever to serve in the U.S. Senate. So she is in that sense a trailblazer. Whether she has a successful vice presidency depends on the success of Biden. And part of Biden's success depends on her success. So they're very much entwined here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're coming towards the end of the podcast. It's been great speaking to you, Dan. And I have one final question. Now, we've discussed, obviously, your book on Kamala Harris, but I would like to turn to a question that is perhaps more related to your journalistic career. You've obviously been a journalist for many decades. And my final question is, if you could interview any politician from American history or European history, going as far back as you like, and have an exclusive sit-down interview with them, which politician would you pick?
Well, so I guess he's not necessarily a politician, but the political figure I would really love to interview, and I assume you're saying living, former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. He was a conservative. He was appointed by Ronald Reagan. He grew up in Sacramento, which is where I spent, you know, 30 years of my career working. So I know some of you at Sacramento. And he was appointed as quite a conservative, but he was the one who wrote the decision legalizing same-sex marriage. He wrote landmark decisions on prison conditions. Very interesting character, and certainly in California history, and in America. And then he's the one who retired and then was replaced by Kavanaugh. So I wonder whether he regrets that. Probably not. I think he probably likes Kavanaugh, although Kavanaugh is going to be much more conservative than he is. Anyway, I mean, I just think the U.S. Supreme Court and Supreme Courts in the various states are incredibly important, and Anyway, so I think Anthony Kennedy would be one. I would, you know, love to interview Boris Johnson too. I mean, he seems like quite the character.
Well, hopefully you will get the chance to interview both of them one day. Perhaps.
There we go.
Thank you once again for coming on the podcast, Dan. If people want to find the book, if people want to buy the book, where should they go to buy the book? And if people want to follow you and find out more about you, where should they go to find out more about you?
Well, I'm at Daniel Moraine on Twitter, and you can find the book at your bookstore or on Amazon. Go to Simon & Schuster and buy it there. It comes out in paperback in January, but you can get it on audio, listen to it while you're doing yard work or whatever, or on your Kindle. So it's widely available.
Fantastic. Well, it's a book that I highly recommend, and I hope people who are listening to this podcast who haven't already bought the book go out and buy it. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Debated Podcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.